just getting back to the system, what we have seen over a number of years is massive recruitment drives overseas, attracting people from Europe, England, Ireland. Nothing personal against any of those people, but dealing with cultural Aboriginal people having just arrived from Ireland or another country is, I'd suggest, not a good starting point, because there's a bit of groundwork that needs to be done if you're looking after an Aboriginal child.
I must agree with you wholeheartedly there, because that was one of my, I guess, pet hates, was people basically getting off the plane and taking on some serious roles. 2 minutes later, we've unleashed these people on Aboriginal families in remote community and in townie even. And, you know, some of these people didn't know Australians, let alone Indigenous Australians. I recall, I guess, even my partner going out to a town camp here, and the non-Indigenous workers writing frantically about the risks in the community where, you know, we're especially down here in the centre where, you know, people obviously have lots of fireplaces. And, you know, we're to people growing up here in Alice Springs, you know, that's not considered a risk. You know, children learn very quickly about what's dangerous and what isn't, and, you know, not to put your hand here and touch this and all that. But you had people weighing up these risks, you know, when there was, you know, fireplaces in backyards and things like that.
It's interesting the interpretation that comes from others about the ability of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to manage and look after children. I mean, we're talking about the oldest surviving culture on Earth. Over that time, they had some system that's obviously worked.
We certainly have got a track record in that regard, and, you know, we know how to raise children. We've had, been around on the planet a lot longer than people may realise, and I guess the serious thing about all that is that staff have been there 5 minutes, then start telling other new staff. The frightening thing was, you know, a lot of young social workers coming into the department, you know, started to learn shortcuts very quickly, and basically driven, as I said earlier, driven by statistics, driven by meeting caseload demands and driven by a number of things. And then I guess then they were writing care plans on children without even consulting families. And I recall one of my colleagues who refused to try and, you know, write care plans unless he's consulted the families. But I guess we found it was a practice right across the board where families weren't consulted. The carers, the foster carers, maybe about the only people that were consulted, that even the child weren't consulted, and you know, and care plans were being written about children. But more importantly, the care plans weren't passed on to parents. In the commission, the public meeting, I was asked about reunification, and I guess I've had a little bit more of a think about reunification, and I guess I should have said from the outset that doesn't happen. Reunification doesn't happen because we don't even work and see families and see children. And when reunification does happen, it's a case of sending an Aboriginal worker out to the community saying, listen, you know, do you want this kid back? It wasn't a case of assessing things to work with them to see whether mum and dad has really progressed along the line or whether mum and dad actually got well. It was a case of, you know, dumping the child back with mums and dad. For instance, if a carer was going into state and they wanted to hand the child back, you know, that's when reunification happened in some cases. The fact that children were even taken into state with their foster carers without even informing the family. You know, family were finding out later on that their child now lives in Queensland, for instance. And as I said earlier about the foster care system, I think I take my hat off to foster carers, and I really, the fact that I'd done a fair bit of, endeavoured to do some foster care training in the department, and you know, we must value foster carers, there's no doubt about that at all, but at the same time, the foster carers, some of them felt that they owned the children and the department had parental responsibility, and foster carers in a lot of cases challenged the department on many occasions about the fact that they thought they owned these children, and, you know, they would deny children having access to their families when their families would come into town because they're busy, because they've got something else is happening with the foster care and the child, and they're having some other activity where parents, you know, were denied access to the children. But even when they would have contact, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was sitting in the front of the Department of Children and Families little courtyard there, and, you know, that's just unhealthy in itself. The lawn wasn't mowed, you know, it was a filthy little area. The visiting room in the Department of Children and Families office had toys that were outdated, had toys that never even, you know, got a wipe over from some of the, you know, when other people are playing with them, and about health risks, they sit around there broken, and children are supposed to thrive in that environment. And as I said earlier, I found it very, very alarming that for a so-called child-focused agency, they didn't even have facilities to take children into care. And you know, the department, any government agency who pretends to have parental responsibility of children it just doesn't work. I think there's, you know, better ways to do business, and I guess we've seen some of those practices in other states about what is best for children, and you know, we know from the outset you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to understand that, you know, children are best placed with mums and dads, and it's about mums, and it's the only mum and dad they know, and they love their mum and dad, and at the end of the day, it's about working with and trying to build on that, and, you know, if it's last resort that mum and dad really are not in a position to care for the child, we need to really consider other options. And those other options are looking at, you know, other kinship carers and, you know, as I said, part of the Section 12 of the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle, making sure that you follow those procedures down pat. But you had the Chatham Giles and John Elfring talking about the fact that Section 12 of the Act really is, I guess a hindrance, where it's important our children get these safe homes and that. But I've also worked with families. I remember travelling one day and taking a child out to Manangreet, and the Aboriginal fella says, the young fella says to me, you know those Aboriginal dudes? And that was really alarming for me, because those Aboriginal dudes he was talking about was him, me and us and his families and his brothers and sisters. And sadly, he's grown up in a white setting, and you know, he's been living very comfortable in this non-Indigenous setting. But at the end of the day, our mob look for our people when they get to 17, 18s and 19s, and they start to question, how come I'm a black guy and I'm living in this white family? And it's not all roses at the end, under the road for 18-year-old and 19-year-old Aboriginal kids. They become, you know, they start to mingle and associate with other 17 and 18-year-old Aboriginal boys and girls, and you can, I've seen cases where, you know, so-called foster carers really love these children and that, but as soon as something happens, you know, the 17, 18-year-old has a fight with the other foster carer's son, they're soon out the door pretty quickly, you know, or they get into trouble with the law, and, you know, the environment's not that rosy after all, you know. So I guess this scenario that we keep hearing, how these kids are in safe environments, yes, I can say it's a really nice, lovely setting that they're sitting in and I guess, you know, being raised, but at the end of the day, I worked in the prison system, and sadly a lot of those kids graduate into the prison system, and that's been my experience of, you know, my couple of years working at Broome Prison, for instance, where a lot of kids, a lot of adults now in the adult justice system were young kids that actually come out of child protection.
There are obviously some massive changes that need to be introduced in the Northern Territory, and hopefully this Royal Commission will make those recommendations. Again, we know that recommendations are just that. It's up to the government to implement the recommendations. But if there is a starting point to overhaul the system, where would you begin?
We've seen lots of reports, and, you know, we've heard from Pat Anderson, Muir Bamblett, about the fact that, you know, people put a lot of energy and effort and work into previous royal commissions. I, for one, for instance, when I first started in the Department of Children and Families, I remember being handed the coronial inquiries and inquests into children that have, you know, that had died in care, and sadly there was a number of failures on the department's part. And when I picked that report up and read that report, that was my early days of working in the Department of Children and Families. It was alarming for me, the fact that, you know, 7-8 years down the track, very few of those recommendations ever got implemented. And a bit like, you know, the overrepresentation of, you know, Aboriginal people in the justice system, the very few recommendations ever get implemented. They end up, you know, gathering dust on somebody's shelf. But I passed around the coroner's report, and I guess I got hammered from senior staff in the department that they didn't want this document to be circulated around the department. And I was, again, you know, that was early in my piece there, you know, for me, the alarm bells went off, because when I read that particular report about the young lady that's passed in care, I guess the first thing as a worker in the system, I wanted to make sure that some of those practices, I wanted to make sure that I didn't repeat them myself personally. And I wanted to make sure that when I read them, I wanted to really make sure that the shortcuts that was highlighted there and the failures on the parts of staff there, I thought it was useful that all staff should read those particular documents and take on board the fact that if we fail to, you know, stick to the rules and follow procedures and policies and procedures, because that's what they're designed to protect children. When we start taking shortcuts and start ignoring them, children become at risk. And I guess I realised that early that it wasn't driven about the best interests of children. It was driven by senior staff managers who were really there to keep their jobs and to look after their mates and give their mates team leader jobs. And, you know, and they become a little purple circle of people that are part of the problem. I found that out early when they really didn't want to know about, you know, the Indigenous workers, how to maximise and utilise this very valuable resource in a department where 98% are Aboriginal children. You know, and I always said that if they were 98% of, you know, Greek kids, you'd guarantee that there'd be a lot of Greek people working in the department and making some, you know, decisions that suits the Greek culture and the Greek people. And I guess when I, you know, use that sort of language, I guess you got cut down pretty quick. And as I said earlier, I do welcome the spotlight being put on the Department of Children and Families, the overrepresentation of children in the justice system. You know, we had things like processes for, you know, about giving children warning, about, you know, some measures prior to even charging young children. And, you know, nine times out of ten, it was usually the non-Indigenous children that would get those particular services. When I was a probation parole officer, I found that in the department painted us all with the same brush. And that's the culture of the department, is really making sure that you toe the line and you don't question, you don't challenge, because at the end of the day, I would have thought that when you challenge, you know, process, procedures and all that, you get more traction in terms of making decisions that are in children's best interest. But I welcome it and I look forward to, I guess, how the things roll out and if in any way, shape or form that I can contribute to that. And I certainly have lots of things I really do want to talk about further in relation to the department, and I'll make sure that I'll be putting my submission in.
Kimberly, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity this morning.